So my guest today is Frédéric Guilbert. Frédéric is a philosopher and bioethicist who is affiliated with a number of universities and research institutes around the world. He is currently a scientist fellow at the University of Washington in Seattle, but he has a concomitant appointment with the Department of Medicine at the University of British Columbia in Canada. On top of that, he is also an ARC DECRA research fellow at the University of Tasmania in Australia. Frédéric has written about a range of bioethical topics over the years, but his current research focuses on the ethics of intelligent implantable brain devices, in particular the effects of brain-computer interfaces on the sense of self, autonomy, agency, and control for patients who are being treated with neurological and psychiatric conditions. So yeah, I'd just like to welcome you to the show, Frédéric.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for your introduction and invitation to join you and discuss.
Okay, so we're going to talk about the work that you've done on the ethics of brain implants today, and specifically what are known as predictive brain implants. Now, you've written a couple of papers about this topic, and I think, if I'm correct, you were involved in a trial of this technology on a group of patients a couple of years back.
Yeah, involved it, yes.
So our conversation today is going to be structured roughly around one of the papers that you published that emerged from that study, and the paper is a threat to autonomy, the intrusion of predictive brain implants, and it was published in the American Journal of Bioethics in 2015. Now, I think this is a fascinating topic and deals with something that I think is really quite interesting and potentially disturbing about an emerging technology. So I'm looking forward to teasing out some of the ethical and philosophical issues that predictive brain implants raise. Now, I'll start with just an obvious question, which is, what is a predictive brain implant? And I thought maybe we could just divide that into two sub-questions. The first is just, what is a brain implant more generally? And then what differentiates predictive brain implants from the more general type of brain implant?
Yeah, so I will start with the more general type of brain implant. The most common known is cochlear implant. So we put that in the brain to help people that can't hear to have some experience of hearing. But the other type of brain implant that we know, it's called deep brain stimulation, and it helps to treat neurological pathologies such as Parkinson, dystonia, severe tremors. And basically, they are what we call open-loop technologies. So DBS allow you to stimulate specific area of the brain, so it is open, so you turn on the switch, if you will, and the electricity stimulate a specific region. But when you think about predictive and advisory brain device, it's a bit more advanced and novel. So you have to think about these implants as intelligent implant or smart implant. And they fall under the umbrella of brain-computer interfaces. So here the difference is that these brain-computer interfaces are closed-loop device. What it means is mean that the technology interact and adapt to brain activity. And if the technology will, for instance, turn off if the brain do not need stimulation, for instance, but will readapt. And the particularity is that it can capture the signal from the brain, convert that or translate that into data, and that data can help to activate, for instance, a prosthetic arm or a therapeutic response. So there's plenty of possible application, but the predictive one will capture a brain phenomenon, translate it in something to bring up a therapeutic response.
Okay, so the classic type of deep brain stimulation device that's used to treat somebody with Parkinson's, they literally contain carry a switch around with them that they can turn the device on and off, and they can modulate the way in which it acts themselves. So that's the classic open loop type.
Exactly. So here we have to be careful. So the patient cannot activate themselves. So the medical team will increase or decrease the stimulation. But the difference with a predicting device is that you have got a patient-specific algorithm. So an algorithm which is specifically designed for the patient. And the algorithm is trained to learn how specific neural events are correlated with some specific symptom or some behaviors, for instance. This is here the distinction.
Okay, so it's a personalized form of the technology. You've got an algorithm that's adapting to the information that it's reading off the individual's brain.
Precisely, exactly. And which is then linked with an outcome. So it can discharge, for instance, electricity, or it can discharge a drug, for instance, or it can alert the patient. The subtlety is that it predicts it. ahead, for instance, rather than just acting on when it occurs.
Yeah, so it's anticipating what the brain is going to do and performing some action or doing something to the or it can do something to the patient. We'll get into some of these distinctions in a moment, actually. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Classic open-loop DBS devices are used, as you mentioned, to treat Parkinson's or things like depression. What kinds of things can predictive brain implants be used to treat at the moment?
Yeah, so the world first in human clinical trial using these technologies have been successfully completed in terms of predicting epileptic seizure. So in short, the predictive brain implant did receive and analyze an ongoing electroencephalography signal that were recorded directly from brain activity of patient. And then patient were receiving some advice on how to react in return to the forecasted event. So basically the patient were alerted ahead of their epileptic seizure. So for instance, they had the opportunity to take a medication or just, you know, take a nap or depending on where they were or what they were doing. So they had to adapt. But the first time that we tested in human were in epileptic patient. The technology would probably not stop at only predicting epilepsy. Perhaps we also will have a chance to chat about it later.
Yeah, I think we'll go into some of the speculations on ways in which this could be used in the future. But so far to date, it's epileptic patients. That's all they've been used to treat.
Yes.
And just to clarify for people who are listening, and I don't necessarily have this knowledge, but a person who suffers from epilepsy, their brain goes into seizure states. I guess you get like coordinated patterns of firing across different brain regions or something along those lines. Is that what happens?
Yeah, that would go along these lines. So the characteristics of epilepsy, of a chronic epilepsy, is that it's very, it's never the same location. It depends on each individual. And the biggest fear of this patient is that the seizure can strike at any moment, and it's not clear how it starts. But now with these algorithm, with the artificial intelligence, for instance, we are capable of now of identifying and capturing ahead the premise of the seizure, for instance.
Yeah, so we're capturing some kind of data or biomarkers or information that is predictive of seizure, and that information is then useful for the patient who suffers from this condition. There are different types or types of functionality, I should say, for a predictive brain implant. And in the paper, you distinguish between a few different forms. Now, I think I admitted in an email to you that I'm not entirely sure about what your classification was, but the way in which I read it is that there's like a kind of a purely predictive type that provides information to the patient about the prospect of a seizure. And then there's an advisory type of predictive brain implant and then a fully automated type. So maybe you could explain the differences between those different types and correct me if I'm wrong in thinking that there are three types.
Yeah, no, there's basically three types. I will start with the first and the last one that you mentioned. So predictive device, you can think of them as strictly alerting patient without any content. So the information do not have other content than just alerting. Automated system are a technology such a brand called NeuroPace. So the system is implanted and do not even bother to inform the patient. So it does not even keep the patient in the loop, if you will. So it was discharge and electric stimulation. But here, when you think about advisory device, it's a bit more subtle. With advisory device, we refer to the device capacity to inform in advance a patient on how she should act in order to avoid specific neuronal event. So to some extent, this functionality can be understood as providing prescriptive measure to be undertaken.
And how would that information be provided? In what form would that information, that advice be provided?
Yeah, so in the first in-human clinical trial, they were visual and audible display. But you can, it was the first time ever that it was this on this planet, so you can think that it was pretty primitive. But you can think in the near future that these prediction or these forecasts will come, or these advice will come on your smartphone, and they will have some content, for instance. So the advisory feature is that it is more than just a simple notification. In fact, it suggests a repertoire of possible therapeutic options. So imagine a smart implant let's say, connect to a sort of a Google Maps / GPS. Okay, so you are downtown walking, and suddenly the device advises you that you're about to have a seizure, unless you buy this specific drug at this specific store, right? Or that you have to buy this specific drink, which has some, you know, specific chemical thing into it. So by informing you with some content in advance, right, the device is somehow capable, I would say the advisory device is capable of influencing your choice, your deliberation, your decision-making on how you should act in order to avoid a specific neuronal event.
Like the way I might analogize this is that the first type of device is it tells you that something's going to happen, that it predicts that an event is going to happen. And it could be like it's like flashing a warning sign or something, or it's providing some kind of visual or auditory clue that an event is going to take place, but it doesn't say anything else to you. It doesn't tell you what you should do to prevent that event from taking place, or it doesn't recommend any course of action. Whereas the advisory implant goes a step further and it warns you that the event is about to take place, and then says, and here's a path that you could follow to maybe mitigate or minimize or prevent the event from taking place.
Yeah, exactly. So with advisory, there's a sort of content. Then, of course, now we can sort of speculate. I mean, we are in the early ages of the technology, but you can think in a future that the content might have some interest from the company that provide the device itself. So we can think in a context where, perhaps also we can talk about it later, but just to start talking about it, if the device is provided by a company for free, so they say, we will pay for the intervention, we'll take care of the bill, we're going to put that in your brain, but in exchange, you have to pay for the drug. So, and then the drug is very expensive, so you can see that at that point, the advisory device might tend to give favor to a specific type of drug or specific interest, financial interest, if I may say so.
Yeah, and I think we have every reason to suspect, unless we are very effective in organizing ourselves or arguing against this or at this point in time, that that will happen, since that's pretty much what happens with a lot of other technologies already. Yeah,
it's a possibility.
Yeah. And again, then just to clarify as well, on the last type, the automated type, as you envisage it in the paper, is that the automated type would actually do the thing for you. So it would perform the medical intervention, let's say, on your behalf without any input from you.
Yeah, exactly. So we might have a chance later to talk a little bit further. But yeah, so there's currently a company called NeuroPace that has implanted, I think it's around 150 patients so far. It was approved by the FDA in 2013, if I recall right. And yeah, so it's basically a sort of DBS device that predicts epilepsy and stimulate the brain just prior to the seizure. So it's a sort of it's a closed-loop device. Not much have been published actually about it. It's still a bit, it does exist. It's being tried. But the automatic system doesn't give you at all any chance to decide of your treatment, if you want a treatment or not.
Yeah, so it decides what to do on your behalf, in a sense.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I had a question that I put to you before this conversation. I don't know if it makes any sense, but I'm just going to ask it again and see if it there's an idea here that's worth exploring, which is that I'm not sure if you can have a predictive device that gives you some kind of warning signal that doesn't have some kind of advisory impact or advisory consequence, just insofar as that if you're providing information to somebody about what's going to happen to their brain, like, why are you picking this information over anything else? It must be because it has some kind of therapeutic or personal importance, and it kind of necessarily carries with it the implication that you should do something in order to prevent this from taking place. So it kind of has a built-in advisory component to it. Now, maybe it's less advice than telling you exactly which drug to take or which drink to purchase at a shop or whatever. But it's it seems to me like if you're warning somebody or telling somebody that something's going to happen, you're necessarily giving them some kind of advice.
I agree with that, actually. By predicting a specific outcome, and if it happened that most prediction in the past were true, you're likely to execute or follow the forecast, okay? But the tiny difference, as you mentioned, is that the prediction itself, although it can be very, it become a form of prescription, actually, that you have to follow, the difference with the advisory is that it will not specifically orient you or manage how to respond with any form of interest. Of course, both, I mean, metaphysically speaking, if you will, I think they are strongly compatible because actually it rely on the notion that you are in a sort of epistemic dependency. You depend on some information that appear on your device, for instance, and you don't have any other source of information aside this very prediction. So being the sole or exclusive source of information, it becomes somehow the most reliable, the most valuable to you, and you are likely to follow it. But again, the distinction would be that by only alerting, then you still have the option of ignoring it or do something else or just sit in a chair and wait. But when you advise and recommend to do X and Y, and if the price X and Y have worked here, I think the intuition is that you might follow X and Y and not question much the content of the suggestion.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, that then really becomes the core of the ethical objections or concerns that you might have about this technology when it relates to individual autonomy. However, we'll come back to that issue later on.
Yeah.
I just want to initially discuss some other more kind of mundane medical concerns you might have about this technology. So, like, is it safe to use it? Is there a risk of infection? What if it picks up the wrong kind of signal? Like, I mean, have these things been explored and tested?
Yeah, so actually, it might sound a bit surprising, but so when you put something in the brain, most of the time it's rather safe, if you will. But yeah, of course, when you put something new, we tend to use the same material. But if you put something new, you have to test for biosafety, for instance. If you have to watch if there's a harm done to the neurons, for instance, you have to test the biocompatibility to see if the neurons can tolerate the material. So, and also, I mean, to be transparent here, during the first in-human clinical trial, it was observed that in one case, I think the device did migrate. So it means that the device has moved a little bit. It might sound a bit okay, but actually you have to think that in the brain, when you stimulate one specific area, you have potentially some catastrophic outcome or behavioral outcome. So if you stimulate, 3 millimeter above or below a spot, you might have, hypomaniac phenomenon, or you might have hypersexual phenomenon. So when you think about the fact that the device might migrate, so you might have very catastrophic behavioral outcomes. So these are basically the safety tests. But in overall, it was pretty, very, very safe, actually. Very successful.
Yeah, and the thing that's worth pointing out here, I guess, is that there is a reasonably long history of implantable brain devices of some kind. And I guess there are reasonably well-developed safety protocols when it comes to implanting these devices.
Absolutely, yeah. So DBS have been around for, we are in 2017, yeah, more than 20 years now. Yeah, no, yeah, exactly. There's a strong history. It's not new. These are very low percentage of people that have very severe adverse, physical adverse effect. We can talk about that later, but there's also psychological side effect. But generally speaking, they are very, very safe, yeah.
Yeah, so I think it's maybe another category of issues that are of most interest to philosophers and ethicists thinking about this, which is what is the impact of these devices on our sense of self and autonomy? And these are really the core of your interest in this as well, as far as I understand. So, I mean, let's just start for general audience here as well. Again, what do you mean by autonomy, and what do you take that to consist of?
Etymologically speaking, the concept of autonomy means self-rule or self-government. So it has commonly been linked to the notion of freedom with some semantics such as self-determination or free will, free choice, free decision, and so on. But to define autonomy, I really like Alfred Mealy's definition or reduction, I would say, the term, where he associates autonomy with the concept of control. So according to his account, autonomous decision or autonomous choice require that an individual exercise control over her decision or choice. So it means that in that respect, autonomy encompass self-control, or as he called it, being a self-controlled individual. And of course, that's not enough to be in control of your decision or your action to be autonomous. For him, you actually need to identify, you need to endorse the sort of control behind your action or behind your decision. And I think that's perhaps where there's a sort of crack, and where, you know, advisory device or predictive device might challenge or raise some concern, because we have to understand, we'll ask whether or not a technologically self-controlled individual may experience a sense of autonomy. So we have to ask if this individual being technologically controlled can experience autonomy while being fully under the influence of predictive and advisory functionality.
So, I mean, there are a few different directions I almost want to go in here, but let's just draw a line under the kind of concept or idea of autonomy as self-control. So you adopt that Alfred Millet's definition of it. I mean, another definition that I like is Joseph Raz's. It's a little bit more complicated, but basically he says, like, to be autonomous means that you have to have options available to you, and you have to be independent in your choice among those options. Now, that can raise some thorny questions around free will and determinism, which I don't really want to get into, but I think it's possible to understand that even if you are a determinist when it comes to causation. So you have certain options, and you're independent in the way in which you choose among those options. So there's nobody manipulating you or coercing you or interfering with your decision. And then the other condition that you mentioned was from Millet, but, you know, you endorse the reasons for your actions as well, or you endorse the choices that you made. That seems to be an important component in autonomy. Now, I guess the critical question then becomes, a patient who has one of these devices implanted in their brain, and it either advises that they do something or it does something on their behalf, do we undermine or compromise their autonomy? And there are actually two perspectives on that question that you explore in the paper. I mean, one is, I guess, the objective kind of philosophical perspective. What do we think about it, looking at it in a third-party perspective with somebody with such a device in their brain? But then there's also the first-person phenomenological perspective. Does the patient feel like they're exercising autonomy? And you looked at both of those. So, yeah, let's kind of tease out some of the points here. So do you think, let's say from the third-party perspective, the philosopher's perspective, does an advisory predictive brain implant undermine our sense of autonomy?
So, yeah, so your question is very interesting. So, I mean, from the third perspective, we often conceive the fact that if you have an external device in your brain, that might, you know, be the first step of having you not autonomous, for instance. It's often linked in bioethics with the notion that we need a sort of absence of external control on our decision, in addition, of course, of intention of acting or volition of acting and competence to appreciate, you know, so this three category here. But there's a difference. I mean, I'm not the... It's Sabine Müller and Henrik Walter who brought that back in 2010, where he said actually being externally controlled by a device is not enough. Actually, what really matter in terms of autonomy would be that if we need an absence of internal controlling influence. And here the absence of controlling influence has to do with the phenomenology of being, or the phenomenology of experiencing your action as free, despite the fact that it is not. And Müller, for instance, she refers often to some psychiatric condition where, for instance, I don't know, addiction, for instance, where, you know, yes, I'm free to have drug, I'm taking drug, but internally speaking, the person is not free at all. There's a form of, it's an addiction. So there's internal controlling influence on that respect in terms of choice, deliberation. So here, we might have the same sort of panorama when we think about predictive device, where patient choice might be compromised by the need to know ahead, for instance, and I mean, would experience that as a sort of a flourishing moment because they are somehow expanding their way of being, but in fact, they would simply execute and follow the instruction of a device telling them what to do.
Yeah, I think an analogy here that might be useful and make this more concrete for people would be a device that I suspect a lot of people use in their daily lives, or maybe not daily, but on a regular basis, which is like a GPS device. You mentioned this earlier on. So, I mean, are there cases in which you think that the use of a GPS device, which gives you a certain recommended route to follow, undermines your autonomy? And does that transfer over then to the case of the predictive brain implant?
Yeah, so, yeah, well, the GPS, this is a very, very great illustration. So, yeah, so, I mean, most people, as you said, use GPS. I do not have a mobile phone, so I'm still one of the rare human beings with a mobile phone. But so when people use their GPS, they of course, have the feeling that they are free because, you know, they rely on this device. And of course, it's great. But at the same time, simply indicate that you're more dependent of a system rather than the other one. So if you think about the new sort of generation of kids growing up with this device, they won't have any other alternative. They will only have this Google map to rely on. They won't even know how to read a map. So with a GPS, you have the ability to access part of the city or part of the planet that you weren't thinking of. But by doing so, you might take some risk of getting somewhere. It would be the same thing with an epileptic patient with a brain device that alert them ahead. So they would potentially put themselves in a spot, or they would push their limits. For instance, they would push their boundaries and behave in a way that they wouldn't without the device. So, for instance, a patient implanted which might simply swim in a pool. So, and for an epileptic patient, swimming is very, very risky because they don't know if they will have a seizure while swimming. But they will have confidence in the device, so they will behave that way. But you have to remember that the device might have some technical issue, might have some technical dysfunction. Perhaps the prediction doesn't work anymore. So there's always a risk that the technology do not work, but at the same time, you rely on the technology so much that it put you in a situation that you won't have any other alternative option. And so we face a technology that perhaps is built to help patients, but in some cases, it might actually generate more harm to some patient in some cases.
Yeah, okay, this is interesting. So in the case of a GPS device, it's useful for me because I want to get to a particular location and I don't know where it is. I'm in an unfamiliar city or country or whatever. And this device is telling me how to get to this place. So in one sense, you could argue that that is facilitative of my autonomy. It's actually increasing or enhancing my autonomy because it's enabling, it's opening options up to me that I didn't previously have. So I wouldn't have been able to easily find this location. However, it also creates a dependency relationship between myself and the technology, whereby I rely on its advice. And if it goes wrong, if it malfunctions or it gives me the bad advice, I might end up in a worse situation. I think actually we had a conversation about this last year at a conference we were both at, where I was describing it was in Paris and I had to find my hotel.
Yeah, Paris. Yeah, yeah.
I had to find my hotel in Paris, so I had it plugged into my Google Maps. And I just got off the train station and the Google Maps was telling me that the hotel was down a particular street and I was walking around, you know, with the phone out in my hand, just following my dot around the screen. And if I had just looked up and looked across the road, I would have seen that my hotel was just across the road and the name of the hotel was across the road. But I was so dependent on the device to find it so that I didn't trust any of the other external environmental information. So yeah, that seems like a clear case of a dependency relationship. And what you're saying is that the same thing can happen in the case of the patient with the predictive brain implant, as in the swimming example, that, okay, it opens up an option to them, but if the device malfunctions in some way, and because they're so dependent on it, they're put at risk in various.
Your illustration is funny, but also quite interesting because it showed that at some point you sort of ignore anything else. You just want to trust your device and all your future will rely on this device. So it put you somehow in a decisional vulnerability where you have been somehow preconditioned by, you know, previous interaction, and you reached a point that you will simply avoid trusting any other source of information. And in some case, I mean, the biological phenomenology might be better, actually. It can also be the case with sort of Fitbit type of device that telling you, oh, yeah, you still can run fast. Here's your heart pulsation. And so the device can tell you, well, okay, according to the data, you still can run fast. But you know, but you, for instance, you might start to be experiencing a heart attack. Who knows? So, but there's you know, a point where the technology is supportive, is assisting you, but you still need a sort of alternative option to help you out of that.
Yeah, I think that's important because, and it's a concern that I hear people raising quite often, which is just that these devices and reliance on them tends to make us less intuitive. So we're less responsive to maybe internal bodily signals that we might normally be responsive to.
Yes.
So your case of the person using the Fitbit, so the data says, oh yes, I can run this fast, and I've done this run before in this weather, and why am I slower today? I shouldn't trust my body, what my body is telling me. I should trust what the device is telling, what the data tells me. And I guess like there's an argument to be made on behalf of that view on some occasions, but on other occasions it can be a negative thing because we lack that intuitive knowledge tacit knowledge that we would normally rely upon.
Yeah, exactly. So also we might have a chance to chat it later, but we have seen that with some patient, the technology did teach them how to recognize some biological phenomenon to alert them that they were about to have a seizure. So we call that aura. So some people have some phenomenon prior to a seizure, and the technology did help them. But again, in some cases, it might bring the opposite where there's such a form of over-reliance, over-dependency, over-trust on the device that someone will be connected, will have a form of cognitive dependence and will be very vulnerable to any suggestion, very, very vulnerable to any instruction or advice given by the device, that it will simply follow them without any questioning it.
One thing that people will often say in response to the kind of argument that you've outlined, or the worry about autonomy here, is that, well, you know, the person has a choice whether to use the device or not, or to rely upon the device or not. And you know, maybe potentially they could have the device switched off if it's that big a problem. And as long as we preserve that kind of choice, then we're not really undermining autonomy. I mean, what would you say in response to that kind of our objection?
Yeah, so yeah, it's a good objection because, yeah, indeed, I mean, the patient's still the ultimate cause, if I may say so, of their decision, of their choice, and in a most case, they of course can decide, oh, I'm not going to follow the instruction, and I don't want to trust the prediction, and we have seen that with some patients actually, but as we have mentioned before, there's a point where a prediction is the ultimate or the only source of available information to you. And there's a sort of a belief, I would say, that if you trust this information above, you have a sort of obligation to follow and trust the device. So it becomes to a point where if you do not trust the device, if you do not follow the advice, well, you are likely to have an epileptic seizure. And if you have, you know, 30 years of chronic epilepsy and you get that in your brain, you're not going to ignore the signal. You have to remember that it's pretty painful, long. So it's no point to get that in your brain if you don't trust the device. So you're facing a point where someone has something in their brain telling them what to do, and the likelihood that they will follow the instruction is very high. So there's a sort of obligation, at least, to think carefully about not doing it rather than the opposite. And again, if you don't do it, you expose yourself to an increased risk of harm, brain damage. And who knows if you swim or if you walk if you are on a sidewalk, there's a car next to you. If you might die, actually, if you have a seizure, don't trust the device. I ignore the device. You might fall in the street, get hit by a car. So this idea that you can, at any case, withdraw and not decide not to, yes. But practically speaking, I don't see it happening much, actually, if the device is very effective.
Yeah, and I think it's actually worth mentioning that you're suggesting that it could be, and you feel a sense of obligation to follow what the device is saying, is telling you, but it could genuinely be an obligation because there are cases. I mean, I teach criminal law. There are famous cases involving people who've committed crimes or, you know, engaged in dangerous driving while having an epileptic seizure, and one of the arguments that's made is that they didn't follow proper protocol or procedure in taking their medication, and that actually makes them responsible for what happened because they didn't follow the prescribed protocol. So in a sense, that creates a legal obligation to follow the best recommended medical advice, which might be what's provided by one of these implants.
Precisely. And it's, as you mentioned, it's in the ramification is even stronger if there's a legal component of why you get that in your brain, for instance. We might also get a chance to chat about it later. But yeah, medically speaking, if the prescription is that you're better off following the instruction. If you do not, then the consequence might be difficult for you to digest after, and you might be more accountable because you didn't actually take the medication.
We've been talking about advisory predictive brain implants so far and their effect on autonomy. What about automated predictive brain implants? I mean, in one sense, you might think that that's more compromising of autonomy because it doesn't even give you the information that you can act upon. But is that right? I mean, is there a chance that it's actually less compromising of autonomy?
If you think about the device that I mentioned, NeuroPace, it can be for some pathologies. So, I mean, if you suffer from epilepsy, actually, we know that because we did ask the patient. Yeah, they prefer not to know, actually. So they would like a device just, you know, to deal with it. They don't necessarily enjoy being involved. Okay, they appreciate, but in some time, you know, if you're about to sleep, you don't want a device telling you, oh, you're going to have to seizure. You would like the device just, you know, discharge the drug. But we haven't reached yet this point in technology. Yes, so in some case, yes, it does help you to be more autonomous. But a nice way to see an automated system in your brain, which is quite distinct from, for instance, an insulin pump. For instance, an insulin pump are great. You know, it's discharge your insulin on an ongoing basis. It's great, but it's not something that is in your brain that might have the capacity to intrude and compromise or disrupt your cognitive ability or your competence to be a person. So something I like to think about these automated brain implant, predictive brain implant, as metaphorically speaking, as a sort of a autonomous device / agent within your own autonomy. So it simply means that it won't give you any volitional control on what the device might do or could do. So there's many interesting cases when, if the software is smart, it's learning, and if it's reached a point where it's actually artificial intelligence, it can actually make decision on your behalf. We might reach a point where the device actually kick you out of any decision and always discharge because the device or the algorithm has evaluated that its own system of decision is way better than your deliberation. So it's reached a point where automated systems might be risky, but it simply means that we have to keep patient, or we have to give the right to patient to withdraw or deactivate the system at any moment. Because also, as we said, if the device has a dysfunction or discharge too much drug or not enough, that would be quite risky for the patient. So if the patient can simply, you know, switch off, that would be great.
So no, I do. I like the metaphor that you're applying here, yeah, because it's almost like the return of the homunculus in a sense. So you're saying,
exactly.
You're like
exactly.
You're inserting a mini AI inside your own brain, making decisions on perhaps without your knowledge. So yeah, there's a sense in which the automated version is even more perhaps disturbing than the advisory version. One of the things about the work that you've done on this is that it's not just purely abstract philosophical work, and you've been mentioning the experience of patients with this technology. Now, you did a study of a patient looking specifically at the question of autonomy. So maybe you could talk about the study that you did and what the results of that study were.
Yeah, so we were interested in the postoperative sense of autonomy, sense of agency, you know, sense of the self. I refer actually to this sense of autonomy as the subjective character of experiencing autonomy by an implanted individual. And this is important because it is potentially distinct, or it is potentially different from how the person might have felt about self before the intervention. So prior the intervention, you might experience your body, your cognitive ability, distinct from what it is after the intervention. So we were interested in the phenomenology of being an autonomous person, or at least we wanted to see the feeling associated with their experience of being autonomous. So yeah, so we have interviewed 6 patients. So there's more paper now. There's two forthcoming now. And so we have observed different type of experience. Most of them didn't experience augmented sense of control. Oh, enhanced sense of control, but we have some extreme cases. So I think I mentioned a little bit this patient that somehow fused with the device. She was relying so much on the device. The device was with her everywhere to the point that she couldn't decide prior looking at the device. So in a way, it was as if the device had to validate her decision to do something. So, but she described, I mean, I will paraphrase her. She was saying something as, because it was the device, it became me. I did find myself with the device. So she talked about she's a true self with the device. And it's just pretty spectacular how it did affect her. It was a perfect relationship. So she was almost symbiotic. But we also had the opposite, where a patient actually felt did experience a loss of control because the device was always alerting her, telling her that she was about, and she couldn't cope with that information. She did experience a form of distress that led her to experience depression. So she had a sort of identity crisis. She used to be a ballerina. She was a university student, and suddenly she became epileptic. But she sort of denied that she was epileptic. But with the device, she realized that she was, and she wasn't ready for this. So the device, by alerting her, keeping her in the loop, had a catastrophic effect on her sense of identity and sense of autonomy. So we did observe an interesting pattern, and I would say that in some cases it was, what I call a form of self-estrangement. So some patients felt different. But again, self-estrangement is not necessarily a negative element. It can be restorative, so some patient will be restored to the point that they don't recognize themselves, but they're happy about it. And so in some few cases was the opposite, where they were so completely a new person that and estranged that they did experience some harm.
I think the studies you've done so far, the numbers of patients are not huge, so it might be difficult to generalize.
Yes, of course. Yes, from them. Yeah, of course.
But yeah. I'm just wondering if there is anything distinctive about, like, so why does one person experience an increased sense of control and another person estrangement and maybe even psychological distress and depression as a result of the device? I mean, one thing that just occurred to me was that would it make a difference, like, how recently you've been diagnosed with epilepsy or how recently the condition has emerged? I'm not sure about the etiology of epilepsy. Yes. I mean, some people, I presume, have it all their lives or from very early on, and maybe some people acquire it later in life. And I guess maybe depending on when they're given this new device or technology, it might make a difference to how they experience it. I'm not sure.
No, it is. So at least that was our conclusion. And it is also based on Sarah Wilson observation with epileptic patient, where if the pathology start when they are actually building their sense of identity, when they are teenage or pre-adult, it's very important. They are likely to have some psychological side effect later. But if you start to have epilepsy when you're 3 years old and you have it for 50 years, I mean, it's basically your life. So, and if someone is actually, be implanted 3 years after the first detection, they might have more issue with it. But again, we have also had a gentleman who was already 55, I think, when he had his first seizure, and he was perfectly fine with being an epileptic patient. I think it has to do with key phase on when, as human, we form our identity. And at least this is what some studies suggest. And again, as you mentioned, we only have 6 patients. We cannot draw a strong conclusion on that. These are just preliminary observation. We're learning, but at least it is indicative that something is happening and that the device has the potential to radically change one sense of the self, one sense of identity or agency, and we need more work on that.
Yeah, but I think that thought that it depends on the kind of phase in life and when you're forming your identity, that seems to chime with the results of other kinds of studies medical conditions. So that might be a reasonably safe speculation in this technology.
Yeah. It is important to identify that, because then you might come to a point where you might exclude some patient actually from these for having this device, for instance. So if we then see that most patients implanted when they are early adult develop depression because they don't want to understand that they are epileptic, so they should not be implanted. So it's a harder protocol than it would be recruiting and enrolling these patients in the trial, for instance. So it's very important to mention that, yes.
Are there similar findings in relation to something like a cochlear implant? Are you aware of any similar findings in that, in terms of the sense of identity?
Yes, there's a massive literature on cochlear implant. I think the cochlear implant element is that children, I mean, we can devote 3 podcasts on that one, but I think the bottom line is that children are not necessarily in a position to evaluate their best interests, but particularly when they have like 5 years old and get that implanted. But I think the outcome, statistically speaking, seems to tend toward, yeah, it's better to have that in their brain. But of course, there's a notion that some parents that are deaf do not appreciate their child distancing. They don't appreciate the fact that some children might not, you know, adopt or embrace their culture of deafness. I think they have this is a valid argument, but I think ultimately, statistically speaking, there's way more benefit of getting the implant early as possible, actually.
Yeah, which actually, as you pointed out, it really raises additional ethical issues, because when you're using an intervention on a child, there's questions of capacity and consent and best interests of child and all. Yeah, so even if it's more beneficial therapeutically, there are more ethical issues, and that could arise with some of these other devices and concerns.
I just wanted to add that precisely when we have a technology that basically can be seen as the earlier the better. So we know that if you put something in the brain as soon as possible, the brain will, you know, sort of develop with the implant, so it will be integrated, embodied, and the way that you will experience life will be quite natural compared to if you wait when you're 30 or 50 to get your cochlear implant or deep brain stimulation for a patient suffering from dystonia. So being argued that the earlier they get, the better for them after that. For instance, if they get the stimulation early on, then they can actually go to school, they can have a normal education. But you know, if you have dystonia, you're pretty disabled. So again, there's a lot of questions. I would say the earlier the better for some technologies. Yeah.
So I want to turn really now towards just more speculation about the future of this technology. So far we've a limited set of interventions on patients with epilepsy, but you know, can the same technology be used to treat other conditions? And I guess more interestingly and possibly concerning, can we use this device to address what we might call socially problematic behavior, like violence? Can we predict when somebody's going to be violent and stop them from being violent?
Yeah, this is very interesting, as you mentioned, very speculative. But yes, but in theory, yes. I mean, these predictive technologies could be used for a range of other pathologies where evidence show that brain disturbance or brain changes occur before the onset of preventable symptoms. So it could be clinically very useful, especially for patients otherwise requiring acute care to either stop or prevent undesirable behavior. So you can think about, politically speaking, about some form of aggressive and violent behavior that start with an onset of specific brain activity. So, I mean, this is not very far in the future. Deep brain stimulation have been tested in patients suffering from aggressive outbursts. So there's about, I'm aware of about 20 patients that have been implanted. So they are suffering from aggressive behavior. They have been implanted with deep brain stimulation. Okay. Now, what is the bridge between, what is the next step before putting in a predictive device in the brain of these patients that will, you know, capture ahead their aggressive explosion or the aggressive outburst, given that we already tested with an open loop? So it's not, the step is not that far, actually. It's a bit more complicated because, you know, you need to train the algorithm, and the patient has to be, of course, responsive. The patient has to agree. But I think it's a probability. And why not then identifying, again, if we're just speaking about artificial intelligence capable of identifying and capturing specific neuronal events, so why not then capturing some form of impulsivity or some form of compulsion, you know, some obsessive compulsive disorder or Tourette syndrome, for instance? And if the device can see ahead that the patient will have a tic, or are too reactive, so why not just, you know, stimulate the patient at this very moment rather than always stimulating them? And I mean, we can still speculate that why not, you know, using that type of technology as a form of condition of release. So again, we can imagine, I'm not saying that I agree with that. I'm just saying, let's imagine a world where we can put that in the brain of pedophile, for instance, and we telling them, well, we can see ahead your sexual urge, so we can release you from prison, but you have to agree to get that in your brain. And not only it would predict, but also, you know, that the device generate data that can be accessed externally, so that the, you know, the police or whoever could access, the judge could access the data and see if the person has been coping well or have been too much excited or all these things. And you can actually remotely, you know, activate the machine if the data seems to indicate it, that it is the case that they are they're having an urge now. So, you know, in case of prevention, if the machine did not cope well, the police could remotely activate the device. So, I mean, this is very speculative, but we have some devices have been put in the brain of some patients suffering from aggressiveness. So it could be possible. The question is, if it is permissible, that's another debate.
Yeah, and I mean, it is worth mentioning that there is a fairly active literature on the use of neurointerventions to treat criminals.
Yes.
And, you know, the use of chemical castration for sex offenders.
Yes.
As you're pointing out here, the analogy between the use of a pill to suppress testosterone or whatever, and a brain implant that can suppress sexual urges, it's not a massive leap, and there are already people debating and being concerned about these issues. And I have actually interviewed some of them on this podcast before, so I'll mention that. So I had an interview with, I guess, Hannah Maslin and John Hugh and people like that, who have discussed some of these topics before. So I'll provide links to those shows for people who want to explore some of these issues in more detail. What I wanted to do with this now is just this conversation to wrap it up is to turn to an objection that I had that I sent this to you before, but I'll read it out to you roughly. It was based to some extent on a reply article to your piece by a guy called Harris Wiseman, Can Brain Implants Stop People Doing Bad Things, where he took you to task to some extent for speculating about the use of this technology to treat people with violence, because he complained that violence is quite a complex behavior and things like that. And now you've responded to some of that already, but I had a related concern, which was to do with an analogy between the debate about brain implants and the historical debate about enhancement drugs. So one of the concerns that I have about a lot of bioethical debates is that they can very quickly become untethered from reality. And, you know, we have a new technology that seems to do something quite spectacular and interesting, and then we speculate about ways in which it can be adapted and used in other contexts, and how it can be applied to other behaviors. So we started out talking about epilepsy here, and now we're talking about stopping criminal behavior, let's say. And in the enhancement debate, the assumption that motivated a lot of the arguments that were made there was that, you know, we're going to be able to create magical pills that will be able to selectively target very complex social behaviors and prevent people from being violent or make people more moral or make people much smarter. But of course, we can't really do that with pills. And I think we know now that we can't do that with pills, because a pill as an intervention is very crude, and it'll target a particular neurochemical or neurotransmitter or whatever. But that neurotransmitter will be expressed in many different regions of the brain and will have many side effects and other consequences. And it won't be able to address the complex behavior that we're interested in part because the behavior that we're interested in isn't purely brain-based. It's also a behavior that arises in a social context. It's relational as well. So my sense, and it could be wrong, is that people have started to be a little bit more wary about assuming that we'll have magical pills. But I'm wondering if there's a danger in relation to brain implants that we have. The debate starts following a similar track, where we just imagine that we'll have a magical brain implant that will be able to target the complex social behavior that we're interested in, and that the magical predictive brain implant will replace the magical pill in our bioethical debates. I mean, is that something we should be worried about?
Not anytime soon, no. Yeah, no, but I perfectly agree. And I think that in my paper I mentioned that this is just speculative, but it is sort of interesting just to think about it. But yeah, I agree with you that often bioethics, but in anyone, I would say a particular subset of philosophers working in bioethics tend to fabricate or fabulate a scenario that are far-reaching and would never occur and happen. I really like Alfred Norman takes on that. He called speculative ethics, and I have a couple of pieces talking about that, where it's what he called it, the if and then syndrome. So basically saying that a lot of rhetoric is based on suppose that, what if, and if then, etc. So the if and then syndrome means that if a technology could be linked to a possibility, even if almost impossible, then we have to explore the consequence. And he framed that into the fact that we speculate, and there's actually consequence of speculating, is that we're not actually devoting enough resource to tangible question, and we're spending too much time and energy on fairy tale storytelling scenario, and by doing that, we might not even looking at the urgent need to implement some protocol, and yes, so yeah, this magical pill rhetoric can be translated, I think, in terms of brain implant, but you know, if you look at some philosopher in the past, I mean if you think about Frankfurt free will discussion, so back in late 60s when the Galdo was implanting brain implant in some bull and some human, so some philosophers started to use this as imagine a mad scientist or evil scientist putting a brain implant and deciding instead of you. I think we were sort of back to that rhetoric that was discussed 40 years ago in science, but then philosophers pick it up like 10 years, 20 years later. And actually part of the debate about free will was generated by Frankfurt alternative possibilities description. So there's a sort of a cycle or a loop where we might coming back. But yes, generally speaking, I'm against speculative ethics. I might have few enemy now by saying that, but I see some parallel, and I think we should devote more energy and resource on urgent need, such that implementing the protocol for first in human, looking at the safety and efficacy of this device, how to exclude some patient, testing the side effect, rather than exploring if it would be used in the brain of my daughter in 40 years to see if she's about to jump in a plane to go in Syria and join ISIS, for instance, which is not going to happen, because as you said, you can't reduce one decision to one particular area in the brain. There's so many elements that contribute to it.
Yeah, so I mean, I do think that the opportunity cost here is important, that we invest lots of resources in the speculation when there are urgent issues that we ought to address. And I mean, just to be clear, I don't think anyone could accuse you of being too speculative. I mean, the paper in question is very empirically grounded and was related to a specific study that you've done. So you're doing the hard work of combining the philosophical.
You're too nice.
Well, the philosophical and bioethical concerns with an actual practical application and intervention. I mean, I am the person who's most guilty of speculation, I would say, in the world, because it's so hard to do the kind of empirical work that you're doing, actually collecting data and finding out what the harms and side effects of these things are. That's too hard for me. I'm staying in my armchair,
I wish I could be in the armchair place. No, but the thing is that I'm affiliated with some center that develops cutting edge technologies. Both work are very important. I mean, there's philosophical question that I would like to work, but because of my grant, I can't.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably a good place to leave the conversation. I'd like to thank you for joining me today, Frederic.
Thank you very much, John.